Okay, I think it's time to get started. Erev Tov, everybody. On behalf of Torah Moshe, I want to welcome you to our weekly Parsha Shir, and it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner, who has been serving the founding Rosh Beit Midrash of the Beit Midrash Zichron Tov here in Toronto. He's really done a wonderful job of spreading Torah in Toronto and beyond, really made a tremendous impact on the community, working with so many shuls and so many people, and he loves to teach. He's a Magid Shir par excellence, many shiurim a week, and it's a pleasure to have him. Before he was at here at Zichron Tov, he served as the rabbi in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and as you heard before that, in Providence, Rhode Island. So it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Turchiner to give this week's Parshat HaShavua Shir. Bakasha.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. It's an honor to be invited back to give the Parsha Shir. As Ruchama said, it's wonderful to be able to partner with Torah in Motion, which an organization which I knew of before I came to Toronto, and really a name that is known far and wide for spreading Torah and raising important topics of conversation. So thank you very, very much for having me. And the topic, as you can see on the source sheet, is the promise and peril of youth. Youth is on my mind these days. Some of you are aware. I am in the throes of a birthday. In the throes of a birthday because I am an Adar baby. So I am past my first birthday, but my other birthday is coming up. And it's a round number and it starts with a five. So at this point, I'm thinking about the promise and peril of youth in the rearview mirror. But in the context of our parsha, we're going to talk about it in terms of the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. And honestly, when you talk about Parashas Kisisa, it feels a little bit lazy to talk about the golden calf. It's easy pickings, but the story is so compelling, and it has so many challenging components. Thank you very much for putting the link in the chat for the source sheet. You have what exactly were the people trying to do with this golden calf? Was Aaron complicit? Why was he complicit? There are so many different pieces to this. And one particular question that I hope to address, which is not really sort of the normal question that gets asked. I'm going to ask people in general. I see we have quite a few people who are who have the video on. If more people could have their video on, that would be great. I don't mind if you're eating dinner. It really doesn't bother me in the least. And I always like to see people. That's helpful for me. So the question that I'm going to ask about this golden calf is a question not only for the calf in our parsha, but also the two calves that Yeravam ben Nevat creates in the book of Malachim, in the book of Kings. And we're going to come back to that story. Just point of order in the conversation. I'm going to use the term bull and the term ox interchangeably. As we go, there are differences technically between them, but both get used relatively interchangeably in Jewish text. And it's a lot easier if we don't, you know, agonize over bull and ox. We're going to treat bull and ox as adult male calf. So when we're talking about a young one, we're talking about a calf. When we're talking about an older one, we may say bull, we may say ox. Please don't get hung up on it. Okay, so here's the question I'd like to point to. On the first source on your sheet, you see two verses, which both come from our parsha this week. Remember the story in brief. Moshe and God present the Jews with 10 commandments on the sixth day of Sivan. The next day, Moshe goes up the mountain and he's gone. And he's up there for 40 days. As the Torah presents it at the end of the Parsha of Mishpatim, the Jews have no idea when Moshe is coming back. They don't know if he's coming back tomorrow. They don't know if he's coming back 10 years from now. They're standing there waiting at the mountain. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari paints a dramatic picture of the Jews in their finery, standing there just like when they received the Ten Commandments, day after day after day after day. And, you know, the weeks pile up and it's 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and there's no Moshe. And finally, they say, you know, we have a problem. We lost our Moshe. And they say to Aharon, make a powerful being for us. What they want is not our focus right now. A God, a stand-in for God, an intermediary with God, a new way to worship God. But we need a new Moshe because Moshe's gone. They say, Ki zeh Moshe ha'ish asher ha'elanu me'eretz Mitzrayim, Moshe the man who took us out of Egypt, lo yadanu mehayalo. We have no idea what happened to him. So make us a new one. And then you get what I brought you in source number one, where Aaron says to the Jews, give me your gold. And they give him their gold. Vayikach miyadam, the Hebrew says. Aaron took the gold from their hands. Vayotzar oso bacheret. And he formed it with cheret. Cheret, some read as a mold. And other read it as using magic like Khartoumim in Egypt. But Aaron is responsible for creating this thing. Vayaseyu egel masecha. And he made it a molten calf. That's the account that we're given here. And then, of course, the Jews celebrate with the calf. Moshe comes down the mountain, smashes the tablets, and says to Aharon, excuse me, but what's been happening while I've been away? And Aharon says, oh, you know these people. Then he says to Moshe, Va'omar lahem, when the people said to me they wanted something new, I said to them, Lemizahav, who has gold? Hitz paraku, remove your gold. Va'yitnuli, and they gave me the gold. And I threw it in the fire. And what do you know? The calf emerged. So in the first version, which the narrator in the Torah is giving us, the calf is formed by Aharon. In the second version, it sounds like something else generates this calf. Now, I'm not going to spend time on the difference between the two accounts. You could explain that in a number of different ways. I'm also not going to address the question of how Aaron could have cooperated. I'm fairly sure you've heard that discussed at one point or another, whether it's because he felt it was a threat to his life or whether it's because he felt he could turn things in a more positive way. He felt that he could stall them. All the different explanations for why Aaron cooperated. Bottom line is Aaron cooperated. And here we have a calf, and the calf is such a compelling image. They all dance around it. It's such a magnetic image that centuries later, it would resurface for the Jewish people. And that's what I referenced earlier in the book of Malachim, the book of Kings. After King David, we get a new king. That king is Shlomo, is Solomon. After Solomon is king for 40 years, his son Rehavam is supposed to take over. Rehavam takes over and he turns off the population very quickly. They say to him, oh, these taxes are too high. And Rehavam says, too bad. And they form a trucker convoy. No, just kidding. Rehavam says, We need to bring down the hammer on these people. He gets bad advice from his advisors. They say, show them you're a real man. And Rehavam says, that's what I'm going to do. And the result is that Yeravam ben Nevat is successful in drawing away the northern kingdom, what will become the northern kingdom of Yisrael. And Yeravam says, I'm not interested in having my people go to Jerusalem for the holidays, going to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple. So he creates two golden calves in different places in the north for the Jews to worship. Golden calves. Wow, that's remarkable that he chose to make golden calves of all things. Like, I thought that story was a disaster for the Jewish people. Why in the world would you want to do that? If you take a look on the sheet at source number two, you find Rabbi David Kimchi explaining. Rabbi Kimchi was, if I remember correctly, 13th century. He says, I'm just going to read out my English translation in the interests of time. Yeravam told them, Aharon made Israel a calf on which the Shekhinah would be manifest. God would be manifest in place of Moshe, whom they lacked because Moshe was gone. You too lack the place of the Shekhinah. You lack Jerusalem in my northern kingdom here. So let's make a calf in its place for the Shekhinah to be manifest. In other words, he just has the first part of the story. Aaron made a calf. I'm going to make a calf too. He leaves out the disaster part that comes next. So we have Aaron making a calf, or a calf being formed with Aaron somehow involved. We have Yeravam ben Nevat creating a calf. We're going to see multiple explanations for why they might want a bull, an adult animal. But they don't make a bull. They make a young calf. And what I want to know, and my principal question here is, why do you create an ego? Why do you create a young calf? I understand the bull. We're going to give four different explanations for why you would choose a bull. But what's with choosing a calf? Everyone clear on what the question is? Okay? All right. So the way I want to approach this is by first looking at four basic approaches to why they chose a bull, and then asking, based on those approaches, if we can understand why they made a young one, why they made a calf. That's where I want to go with it. So let me ask you, you've heard conversations in Shiurim about the golden calf before. Why a bull? Let's leave aside the question of why a young animal. Why would they want a bull? Doesn't look like Moshe. No?
Power.
Power, an image of power. That's a great possibility. They want a bull because bulls connote power. I'm going to take that as my second of the four, but I'll jump to it now since Debbie was kind enough to mention it. The ox is a central positive image in the agrarian society that the Jews knew. I see the note in the chat, and I'm going to come to that one next. That was going to be number one on my list. But let's talk ox first, or bull first, as a power image. In an agrarian society, the bull, the ox, is a power image. It's a positive image. If you look on your sheet at source number four, I brought you from Mishlei, the book of Proverbs, the line, where there are no oxen, the trough is empty. Great produce comes, v'rav tivuot, bekoach shor, with the strength of an ox. That's the image that we have of the ox. It's the provider of grain. Don Isaac Abarbanel pointed that out. As we're going to see a little bit more in a bit, there's an image in the book of Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel, of the divine throne. And one of the images on the throne is an ox. Abarbanel writes in source number five, you know why? He says, ki hu bal ha-tivuot, because this animal is the master of produce, umarbe osam, it increases the produce. And he quotes you that verse in Mishlei that we just noted. He's not the only one who says that. If you look at source number six, the Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah says that in general, the choice for the four images that are on God's throne is that they are all apex creatures. There are four great ones. The Nesher among birds. I chose not to translate the word Nesher because Nesher is popularly rendered as eagle. However, it seems based on a Rashi, it's more likely a vulture. People don't like to call a Nesher a vulture because we're told that we're getting out of Egypt on the wings of Nisharim, and no one really wants to fly on the wings of vultures. So we just, you know, we'll just sort of ignore that. There's actually, I think it's the Sansino. I'm not sure, but I think it's the Sansino that when Nesher shows up in the list of non-kosher birds, it translates it as vulture. However, when Nesher shows up as carrying us on the wings of Nisharim, it translates it as eagle. And I can understand why. But in any case, the Nesher among the birds, that's on God's throne, the ox among domesticated animals, the lion among the wild beasts, and then the human being among all of them. God took all of them and engraved them upon the divine throne. So there's an image of power that comes to it. I reference also, and I see the notes in the chat. I'm going to come back to some of them as we go. I'm not ignoring them, not to worry. Don Isaac Abarbanel makes use of it in terms of another story. Remember the book of Daniel, chapter 4 of the book of Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, has a dream that frightens him. It ain't his first. It is his last. But in his dream, he sees a great big tree. And the tree has fruit and it has branches and the animals shelter in it and people eat it. It's a wonderful, magnificent tree. And then it's cut down. And the images of Nebuchadnezzar. And to make a long story short, if you want, you could read the fourth chapter in Daniel and see just how long the story is. But the prediction, as Daniel reads it, is that Nebuchadnezzar, the king who is represented by the tree, is going to wander off into the wilderness. He is going to be feral until such time as he recognizes the truth of God and repents. That's basically the story. There's more to be said. But an interesting thing happens in the story. When Daniel is interpreting the dream for King Nebuchadnezzar, he says to him, "You are going to be like an ox. You're going to be like a shore. You're going to be like an ox." And the problem is, the dream never said that. It never said he was going to be an ox. It just said he's going to be like an animal. So Abarbanel, in source number 7, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side, says Daniel wants an image that Nebuchadnezzar will like. Daniel said he would eat the grass of the field like oxen, even though the dream as told did not specify an ox. Daniel saw in the dream that he would eat of the grass of the field with other animals. So that means he's a vegetarian. So he would not change to a predatory creature, which would eat meat, not grass. And with his stature, Nebuchadnezzar would not be like one of the deer. He can't just be like a deer. So he says, "You're going to be like an ox, king of the animals, powerful, great produce. Produce comes through the strength of an ox, which we just read before in Mishle, in Proverbs. It's an animal which, when it's young, is strong and it battles with its horns. And in older age, it carries the yoke." That's Nebuchadnezzar. So the image here is the image of the ox as a creature of power, a creature of plenty, a creature of loyalty. If you look in source number 8, Yada Shor Koneu, the ox knows its owner, the donkey knows the trough of its master. I gave you a reference also in source number 9 from Tehillim, where the calf is described as eating the ox is described as eating the grass. Okay, that's all one image. That's all one explanation for why you would want an ox or a bull, because it is powerful. Drawing on the notes here that are in the chat, I saw the reference to them being familiar with this from Egypt, right? A few people have written. I've got 2D's iPad saying, because saw it in Egypt. I've got Egypt also with Yeravam. He could use an Egyptian ally. Query whether Egypt is still using the calf by the time you get to Yeravam, but it's entirely possible. You've got Ruth and David also, other nations worshiping, Amalia also. So indeed, that was the first approach I was going to bring. Historians suggest that this creature is modeled on what they saw in Egypt. The Egyptians worshipped a bull that lived in the temple of the god Ptah. Within that view, I can actually understand why they would choose a calf in particular. When the old bull would die, it would be replaced with a calf. And viewing Moshe as the old bull who is now gone, you're going to replace him with a calf. And in fact, just this week, just the other day, it's a good thing I didn't prepare it too far in advance. I saw an article on the Times of Israel by Dr. Jonathan Frankel, and I brought you an excerpt here in source number 3. The article is titled, "Why a Golden Calf and Not Any Other Symbol?" Pretty apt question. And look what he has to say. "One of the most popular and well-recognized religious symbols in Egypt throughout its entire history was the cult of Apis, a religious entity that revolved around the deified intermediacy of a bull. The cult of Apis, or Hapi, perhaps pronounced that way, I don't know, in Egyptian, was popular throughout Egyptian history, dating back to the earliest dynasties. The Apis bull lived in the temple of Ptah in Memphis and served as the tangible manifestation of an all-powerful god." And he goes through some of the incarnations of this god. "This intermediate allowed commoners access to divine communication. Egyptians would visit the temple to ask the bull questions and interpret its actions as responses from the god." So in other words, following the view that what the Jews wanted was an intermediary to God, like Moshe, here's your intermediary. It's the Apis bull. That's what it did in Egypt. It's what it's going to do for you now. And then he makes a fascinating point in his second paragraph. He says, "The functional comparison between the Apis bull and the golden calf are obvious. However, a bull is not a calf. If the goal was to recreate a classic Egyptian religious icon, then why make a calf?" He says, "The following is an excerpt detailing the cult of the Apis bull, which provides a remarkable insight. It's from a book, A Popular Account of the Ancient Egyptians, Volume 1. Since the Apis bull was a living creature, it would eventually die, prompting the search for a new Apis bull. This new Apis would be a calf. They took it to Neapolis for 40 days of feeding, after which time it was transferred via a boat inside a gold cabin to the temple of Ptah, where it was greeted by the people who came to view their reincarnated god and hope to have their questions answered. 40 days is his is the period of maturing for this creature. So what you see here then is a second option, this one actually explaining why it will be a calf and not a bull. You now I understand a little bit more. But if I take the explanation we just did before, the explanation that it's a powerful creature, it brings the grain and so on, I don't understand why you used a calf. I would have thought to create a bull. I'm going to go to another explanation for why a calf, our third explanation for why they chose this kind of animal. And that is the Merkava, the divine throne that I mentioned to you before. We've already seen that the divine throne includes four entities, and one of them is a calf. The way we know that one of them is a calf is actually interesting. It's a little indirect. I brought it for you in source number 11. But before that, source number 10, Don Isaac Abarbanel says, our sages said that at Sinai, Israel saw this Merkava, this divine chariot, divine throne. Because remember, the text said back at the end of Parshat Mishpatim that they saw the God of Israel. So they saw this Merkava, this chariot, this throne. And they said that they saw the face of an ox opposite their camp. And so they made an egel. They chose to make a calf because there had been a calf on that throne. How do we know there's a calf on the throne? So I brought you the verses from Yechezkel, from Ezekiel, in source number 11, which speak of the different faces on this throne. The first line that I brought there doesn't actually mention the ox. It mentions a cherub, a person, a lion, and a nesher. The second verse there mentions the lion, the ox, a person, a lion, an ox, and a nesher. So if you do the math, you realize that the ox is the cherub. You follow? Did I say that a little too quickly? Again, the first verse that I quoted said, your creatures on the throne are a cherub, a person, a lion, and a nesher. Well, I subtract person because that appears in the second verse. I subtract lion because that appears in the second verse. And I'm left with cherub and nesher. And then nesher is also in the second verse. So cherub in the first verse is linked with ox in the second verse. In other words, cherub and ox are the same thing. And the reason why I stress that is because where did they have cherubs or kruvim as we call them? Where did they have the cherubs?
On top of the Aron.
Sorry?
On top of the Aron.
Right, on top of the Aron, right? As written in the chat also, the Mishkan. Exactly, that's where they had cherubs. So cherubs, there's a debate as to what they were, but one solid view based on these verses in Yechezkel and Ezekiel is that they were actually oxen, which makes sense, by the way, because the word kruv, right? That's the term for a cherub, kruv, sounds an awful lot like in Aramaic, the verb kaf resh bet, which is to plow. So there is a definite link there. There's more to be said about the cherubs, but that's a side note. My point being that they make an ox type creature because that's what they saw on God's throne. And that may be what they have in the Mishkan on the Aron. And then the fourth idea. And the fourth idea is the one that I saw referenced by somebody. Ah, Gershon, how are you doing? The Yosef one. Yosef was Bechor Shor. Moses is the Neo-Joseph. So before we get into Moses being the Neo-Joseph, just on a very basic level, we link the golden calf to Yosef, to Joseph, who indeed was known as the ox. Right. If you take a look on your sheet in source number 13, I'm going to come back to number 12. But look at source number 13, when Jacob is talking to his sons, and specifically Shimon and Levi, he says, Ki ba'apam hargu ish, in their rage they killed a man, uvirt sonam ikru shor, and at their will they uprooted, or wanted to uproot, an ox. They wanted to uproot Yosef. Another verse that's like that, source number 14, Moshe and his blessing regarding Yosef, Bechor Shoro, his firstborn ox. That's Yosef's symbol, is indeed the ox. So that we get the Medrash in source number 12, which talks about how they got the bones of Yosef out of Egypt. Yosef had asked to be pulled out of Egypt and brought along with the Jews at that time. So the Medrash brings us a story about what happened. And if you take a look at source number 12, the version in the Medrash Tanchuma, Yesh Omrim Shem Micha Haya, some say that Micha, and in context, you would understand why it's in quotes, it doesn't matter for our purposes, Micha was being crushed in a building. Micha was a Jewish baby who was being put into a building, when the buildings that the Jews were supposed to be building for the Egyptians. And Moshe saved him from there. And this fellow Micha took a plate on which Moshe had written, Alei Shor, rise, bull, when bringing up Yosef's casket. You know what? I'm making a hash of this by trying to read it out of the text. I'm going to say it outside of it. The idea is this. Moshe wants to get Yosef out of Egypt. Yosef's bones are actually in a casket in the Nile. How we know that is a topic for another time. So in order to get it out, Moshe writes the words, Alei Shor, rise up, ox, on a piece of metal, throws it down into the Nile, and lo and behold, Yosef's casket comes up. Then you have this fellow Micha who Moshe saved, and Micha takes that plate and he throws it in with the gold. And because he throws it in the gold and it says, rise up, bull, this image of Yosef, that's why what comes out is the golden calf. That's the fourth of our explanations. So again, we've seen, to sum up what we've done in the last 25 minutes, I'm not sure why someone is asking me that on the sheet, but on the in the chat. But the point here is that I'm not sure. All right, I'm gonna hold the question until later on. We've got four different explanations for why a bull. The first explanation that we offered was the Apis bull from Egypt. Within that explanation, I understand why a calf. Your old one, the old bull was Moshe. He's gone. We're now starting again, and especially with a 40-day period. That I get. But the idea that the ox is a positive image of power and of plenty in the agrarian society, the idea that you want to emulate the ox on the divine throne as well as on the Aron, on the ark, or the idea that it wasn't even Aaron's decision, but rather this plate was what drew out the bull. Within all three explanations, I want to know, why a young animal? Why not the mature animal? What is it that this is, you know, what is this about? I'm going to pause here. Rather than take some of the questions from the chat, I'll ask you questions on what we've said so far or suggestions on why you would choose a young animal instead of an older one. All the people who wrote in the messages are all silent now.
The young animal represents growth and the future, and the people represent the future nation of Israel.
Very good. So I would have said that what Aaron is thinking is a young calf would appeal to the Jews at this point, right? Like you just said, and in the chat as well, young is vigor. They're a young nation. They're starting out. Moshe, the 80-year-old, is gone, right? 80 was old for them as well. Remember, their military age is between 20 and 60. So let's give them a young replacement, especially if we take the Yosef link. Because Yosef was young when he saved Egypt, when he saved their family with grain, right? Yosef is young at that point. He's 30 when he stands in front of Paro. You could even add, it's sort of this fountain of youth image, right? This God of yours is never going to grow old, is never going to disappear on you, right? That you could definitely read that this way. An answer to the question in the chat, I don't know anything about it being half calf, half donkey. I thought it was just a calf.
About potential.
I'm sorry.
He has potential. A young,
right?
A young thing, whatever it is, has much more potential than an older.
Mm-hmm.
So even right. Moshe is coming back, replacement.
Agreed. Agreed with the idea that this represents potential. I would even add, maybe they feel like a young animal is malleable. You know, it's tame, like they could use it for their own needs. You could throw that into the mix as well. But I wonder if Aharon is not embedding a message to them, particularly if he's the one who's actually shaping it. You chose an image of power, but a young calf, as represented in Tanakh, is an unreliable creature. Young calves are unreliable. I'll give you an example. If you remember the story of David and Michal, right? Michal is the younger daughter of Shaul. Shaul, after David kills Goliath, Shaul tries to marry off his older daughter, Merav, to David. David refuses. Then he marries off his younger daughter, Michal, to David. However, Shaul then surrounds the house. At one point, David is a fugitive. Shaul wants to take him into custody, and Michal saves David, dropping him out the window. She stays, David goes, and Shaul seems to marry her off to a man named Palti ben Laish. How that worked, who was she really married to? Great discussion for another time, but not really the point right now. The point is that by the time you get to the beginning of the book of Shmuel Bet, after Shaul has died, Michal and David are not together at this point. You get a list of the wives of David, and Michal does not show up on the list. But a woman named Eglah does show up on the list, and the Talmud says Eglah and Michal are one and the same. They're the same person. Take a look at source number 15, where a Medrash expands on this and says, why was she called Eglah? Why was she called a calf? Just as a calf does not accept a yoke upon her neck, so Michal did not accept the yoke of her father. Rather, she angered him. The idea here is that Michal is not accepting of her father's yoke, meaning she rebelled against her father. She saved David. So the image here is of somebody who is not tame, somebody who is not going to just go along with what you tell them to do. And in fact, she doesn't go along with David either, right? She doesn't go along with David. The notes in the chat are coming too fast for me. She remember that when they bring the Aron back, when they bring back the Ark of God, and David is dancing in front of the Ark, right? She makes fun of David. She says to David, "You look like one of these empty people celebrating that way." And of course, David comes back at her, and that's its own story. But my point in saying it is that you may think that you're getting something flexible and malleable, right? And I see the note in the chat from the farmer that you can't move a bull where the bull doesn't want to go. On the other hand, the calf can be hard to work with as well. That's one piece of it, but there's more regarding this. Shimshon, Samson, right? In Shoftim, the last of the named judges of the Jews. So Shimshon falls for a Philistine woman, not Delilah. This is his first Philistine woman. He's got three. So the first of them, he actually marries her. And they have a big wedding celebration. And there are Philistines there, and he poses a riddle to them with a wager. And the wager is, if you're not able to figure out the answer to my riddle, then you will have to give me new linens and clothing and so on. And if you figure it out, then I'll have to give it to you instead. And they can't figure it out. And they ask his wife, and his wife gives them the answer. And Shimshon says to them, when he realizes what has happened, he says, "Lulecha rashtem be'eglasi lo metzasem chidasi. Had you not plowed with my calf, you would not have found out the answer to my riddle. You would not have figured it out on your own." But the point is, he calls his wife, who was not loyal, who did not, refuse their requests. He calls her a calf, not in a positive way. And that image of the calf as being unreliable, that image of the calf as something that could actually betray you, is one that continues in Tanakh. Sometimes it's about the calf being pampered. If you take a look at source number 17, I brought you the beginning of a passage from Yirmiyahu, from Jeremiah. And there you see that Egypt is compared to a pretty calf. And the image there is of being pampered and being lazy. In Hosea, the prophet Hosea, in source number 18, Ephraim, which is the northern kingdom of the Jews, is called a trained calf loving to thresh. But they went off and threshed in the way they wanted to, instead of the way that God wanted them to. And he says, "You plowed wickedness, you have harvested corruption, you have eaten the fruit of rejection of God, you trusted your own paths," and so on. And the last verse in this, from Malachi, where he says, "You shall go forth and grow fat like stall-fed calves." That's not a positive image. So what I'm suggesting here, in all of this, is that maybe the point in this image is to say, yes, you want somebody of power because Moshe is gone. You want an intermediary to God, something like what you saw on God's throne. I'm offering you this animal that has that, but keep in mind, the young calf is unreliable. You're turning to idols, and you can't rely on the idols for help. They're fickle. They're not on your side. They're going to do what they want to do. Don't look to them for support. You follow? That's what I'm suggesting here. I've seen a couple of notes in the chat where people have suggested connections to the Egla Arufa, the ritual where a dead body is found outside of town and they don't know who killed the person. And there's a ritual of killing a calf there as part of an atonement process. I don't know what I would do with that here. I can't think of a connection. It could be there is one. I'm not thinking of what the connection would be. I don't know. Does anyone have an idea of what to do with that?
Well, just they thought Moshe was dead too, and they needed to find some solution. So that was where my mind went.
Got it. So in other words, this is, well, Moshe's gone. So that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, the Egel had some sort of, I don't know, oracular quality to like lead them. I mean, in Egel Rufa, it leads you to where the person came from here. Maybe it resolves the mystery of Moshe's disappearance. I don't know. I don't know enough about what the Egel represented. Right. Then.
It's a fun idea. The problem is that the Egel Arufa doesn't lead you anywhere. Meaning it's not about identifying where the person came from. It's just a ritual of purification. Sorry, Rabbi Kelman.
Let me just finish. Egel Arufa is opposite of what happened with Chet Egel. Chet Egel, Aaron is trying to excuse himself, and he does not take full responsibility. And Egla Rufa, the elder of the city, do take responsibility.
Right.
By going and everything else, they are admit that they haven't done enough to protect that stranger. Thank you.
Right. So you're saying that this was a message to Aharon?
That was a message to Aharon.
That's a very interesting idea. That's very creative. I like that. Just to answer the question in the chat, and then Rabbi Kelman was going to say something, I'm not suggesting that Aaron knew about King David to put in a hidden message. My point is to say that the images that you find with the Eglah as unreliable throughout Tanakh, beginning to end, as early as Shimshon and running all the way through Malachi, that's an image that Aaron would have been familiar with. That's what I'm suggesting. Rabbi Kelman, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say, no, I normally wait till the end, but since you ask, and in the first, I think it's the first volume of the Torah Mother Journal, Rabbi Blech has an amazing article of why he became a rabbi. And it's how the Eglah Arufa sort of is the atonement for the sin of the Egel HaZahav. And his point was, it's a long article. It's a beautiful article. And he explains that the sin of the Chet Egel was not the people who worshiped the Egel, but the people who stood by and did nothing. Because only 3,000 out of 603,000 males worship. And when Moshe goes up to plead for the forgiveness, they're already dead. They've already been killed. So what's Moshe going up on the next day? Ulaya kapra, maybe God will forgive us. What do you mean? All the people who sin. So he says the Chet Egel is the sin of omission, not a sin of commission. He describes in Yom Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then he says that's of course the Eglah Arufa. It's a thing of omission. I thought it was a beautiful article, and he explained, he uses that as a springboard why he became a rabbi. I don't know if you had him ever at YU, but anyway.
He was my rabbi growing up. He was my shul rabbi. I grew up.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, and a magnificent shul rabbi he was. I have to say, really, really tremendous. I'm going to go a little bit further with this idea, the idea that there's a message here that you're looking for youth, but you should recognize that that it's going to betray you. This idol is going to betray you. Or not that they're looking for youth, because that's an image that this is given to them, but you're looking for support in the wrong place, essentially. I actually think that even the adult ox, to a certain extent, carries that that message. The ox in the Torah, and when you get to the realm of Jewish law in particular, has two images. There is the ox that is benevolent and that you look at as safe. And the term for that in Hebrew is the shor tam, the innocent ox, the ox that's not known as being anything, any danger. It's just doing its job. And then on the other hand, there's the shor mu'ad. And the shor mu'ad is the one that we've been warned about, the one that we know is dangerous, the one that tends to attack. If you take a look at source number 20 on your sheet, if an ox should gore a man, woman, and they die, and there's a rule that happens in the event that the ox does this, that's where the ox was not known to be dangerous. But then it continues, if that ox was a goring ox from the day before and the day before that, and the owners were warned, and they didn't guard it, and then it kills a man or woman, then the following are the penalties. We have two kinds of oxen. We have the oxen that are benign, and then we have the oxen that are known to be dangerous. And the same thing shows up again a few verses later in the heading in number 20. It should say 3536, not 3526. That's a typo. V'chigof shor ish es shor re'ehu v'mes. If a man's ox should strike his peer's ox and that animal dies, then there's one law. If the ox was not known to be dangerous, oh no, kishor nagahu mitmol shilsham, or it's known to be a goring ox since yesterday or the day before, and they did not guard it. You have two types of shor. You have two types of ox. Sometimes the ox is benign, but sometimes that ox is dangerous. In source number 21, I gave you from Bil'am, from Balak, I should say, King Balak of Moab is scared of the invading Jews. He says they're going to eat up everything as an ox licks up the greens of the field. As a matter of fact, the last source I brought you, in source number 22, when the Talmud wants to give us the laws of dangerous entities and the different types of danger, of harm, the different torts, the first one on the list is the shor. is the ox. It is a source of harm. The ox tramples property. The ox eats things. The ox gores. So not only is the young ox, the calf, dangerous, but even the adult is a mixed image. So just to offer a fast summary here, Aharon or God gave the Jews a calf, whether it's Aharon actively forming it, whether it is done via this this plate that is thrown in. However, we look at it, he threw in the gold and the gold emerged. Whichever way you're going to read that, the Jews end up with a calf. We saw four reasons for it to be a bull. Egyptian idolatry, the great provider among the beasts, something they saw on the divine throne and possibly on the ark itself, on the Aron, the Kruvim, as instructed in Parshas Truma. Or it represents Yosef, who provided for the Jews in Egypt and who was loyal to God. He's a great image. But specifically, it's a young calf. And only within the idolatry approach, the Apis bull, do we understand why a young calf. But I think they would think of it as young and vital and not vulnerable like Moshe and perhaps malleable. But Aaron's message is that this deity is in fact unreliable. And even the adult ox has a dangerous side. So one reason why I like this idea is because it paints Aharon as resisting, even as he complies with the Egel. You know, he, on the one hand, he's going along with it. On the other hand, he's sending them a message. And that's the job of a Kohen, is to send that message. But I also like this idea because I think it reflects a reality of the mistakes that we sometimes make, whether personal or communal, right? We go after the young and shiny in the hope that it's going to supply the vitality that we're looking for. But youth comes with a price. There is something to be said for maturity. There's something to be said with what we gain with experience over time. There's something to be said for somebody who has gone through the furrow, who has pulled the tractor, who has done the work all those years. There's something to be said for the stability and the reliability that they bring to the table. And Aaron is saying, replacing Moshe with a calf may not be the bargain that you think it is. That's what I'm that's what I'm getting at here. I wanted to go back to the story of Yeravam, which I had mentioned at the outset, but then sort of dropped off a little bit. So I see from Gershon here in the chat, the two calves made by Yeravam betrayed the Israelites. The fact that the story in Exodus is about a mere calf is a satire prophetically anticipating Yeravam's sin. That's a fascinating idea. The idea that it's meant to anticipate to forecast what's going to happen later. Not so sure I'm on board with it, but I love the idea, Gershon. But certainly when Yeravam comes along and he creates this calf, the image is we're starting again. And he sells it to the Jews, as Radak said, as we saw before, he sells it to the Jews on the basis of the idea that this, but Aharon did it. Aharon created it. So we can do that also. And it'll work for us as it worked for him. It was a substitute for Moshe. Now it's a substitute for Jerusalem. He's borrowing that same image and borrowing it with the warning, unwittingly, that Aharon has built in. Were there other things in the chat that I did not get to? I just want to make sure that I hit the different points. Oh, I see a note just came in here. A bit of a raya for Eblach's take. The breaking of the neck of the Egla Arufa versus the Amkshe Oref, the stiff-necked people. It's an interesting point for sure, as well as the note about Yeravam spending time in Egypt. It's true. Yeravam had sheltered in Egypt. All true. I think we hit the notes in the chat. Were there any other questions or comments that we didn't get to?
I wanted to make a comment about if you said Aaron is sending a coded message to the people. So the same way Yosef sent the coded message to his father, with the Egla Arufa to tell him that he was coming back. So
that's fascinating. Yeah.
So to tell him that he's still alive and to, you know, to convince his father that he's alive and that they're going to be together again. So then this suits well with the coded message that Aaron is sending, that Moshe is alive and well and they're going to be united again.
Wow, that's interesting. I had not thought of that angle at all. And that, you know, I could have had a much better title for the Shiur also. I could have called it Of Calves and Codes. That would have been good. The okay. Other thoughts? Wow, I don't think I ever finished a Shiur early. The that's a new one on me.
Well, you know, Aaron put a block of gold in the fire. That's the way I read it. And out came the calf. And in that sense, it sort of validates everything that you said, because everything else happens in the future other than the fact that that Moshe said, arise, bull, to take out Yosef.
Right. What do you mean by everything happens in the future?
In other words, the calf came out, and the purpose of the calf was to maybe prophesize what was going to happen in the future and how everything relates, which is just what you said.
Got it. I hear it could, you know, it could well be, if we take the view that it isn't Aaron forming it, that it's, as you said, the way that Aaron told it to Moshe, it came out on its own. You certainly could see that. But again, I want to stress, because I saw the questions, there were a couple of them from iPad in the chat. When I'm bringing all these verses that talk about the calf as an image of unreliability or being pampered and all of that, I'm not bringing it to suggest that Aharon has read Malachi. My point is only to say that it was a popular image. This is what would have resonated for them, and would have been meaningful for the Jews who had been living in Egypt. In terms of whether Aaron got punished for the calf, that's really an interesting question in its own right, as to whether Aaron gets punished or doesn't. At face value is, as you wrote, he doesn't get punished. He becomes the Kohen Gadol. He becomes the high priest. It sounds like he's getting away with it. But as you go further, it becomes less clear that that he's simply escaping from this. There's more to be said about that.
I have previously suggested that verse 9 in chapter 1 of Exodus, Hine am b'nei Yisrael rav, is a prediction of your rav.
It's a prediction of?
Your rav am.
Oh, your rav am. That's interesting. Am b'nei Yisrael rav. Prediction of Yeravam. Okay. I would not have thought of that. That's for sure. Thank you. Okay. Well, then thank you very, very much, everyone. I really appreciate everybody watching, and I hope you found it interesting. Based on the comments, it looks like it was food for thought. So that's good. Then Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi. Of course, you know, I guess you don't want to go there, but that's, you know, what Rashi says, that the death of Nadav and Avihu in Dvarim was really a punishment. So he really did get punished quite heavily. When Rashi said that he was praying for 40 days, I forget the Lashon and the Pasuk there exactly, but Rashi quotes that God listened to half. So Nadav and Avihu died, but Elazar and Ithamar lived. So that's quite a powerful Rashi. I'm sure that's for another Shiur. But thank you very much, Rabbi. A pleasure. We look forward to learning with you in the future and many opportunities to learn with Rabbi Turchiner. Tomorrow morning, of course, my regular weekly Shiur on the Siddur tomorrow at 9 a.m. We kick off next week with Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15. Actually, the last of this current series on how to read a book of Tanakh. And then we continue with throughout our Shiurim the week, two, three, on Monday, Dr. Guhartz and Dr. Shapiro, and then of course our Megillat Esther series continue with Aaron Kohler on Tuesday morning 9:30, etc. So we look forward to learning with you, and as always, please invite a friend And everyone, wish everybody well and Laila Tov. And thank you again, Rabbi Turchiner, and all the best and happy birthday. I won't ask you exactly when your birthday is, but maybe you can have two this year for a very special birthday. Bishnat Hayovel. Okay, so thank you very much. All the best.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
It was absolutely fantastic.
Thank you, Gershon, and please give my regards to Abigail.
I will. You know, she's got the fantastic dinner for her school.
Yes.
Coming up. I hope you watch her video, which is amazing.
Send me a link, please, okay?
I'll have her do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. That's unbelievable.
Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yesh kayach and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Good
Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Okay. Lila Tov, everybody.